The EU and Me, brought to you with the support of the Department of Foreign Affairs, Communicating Europe Initiative.
Yeah, no, this week on EU and Me, we're examining the impact that EU membership has had on the environmental protection and climate action scenario in this country. How has this affected agriculture and fisheries, and what does the future hold for Ireland in these areas over the next 50 years? We want your views, as always, into the programme for us. 0667123666, the number to call us on with those. We'll also this morning have the results of our EU and Me survey coming up. We're going to start, though, by speaking to Professor Owen McIntyre, who's professor at the School of Law in University College Cork and the director at UCC Centre for Law and the Environment. Owen, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Jerry. Thank you for having us on.
Can I ask you, Owen, first of all, look, is it a case of everything changed and changed utterly? 50 years is a long time, but a lot of the laws we have now, we probably wouldn't have if it wasn't for the European Union in this area.
I think that's very true, Jerry. I mean, the significance of Ireland's EU membership for the development and the evolution of Irish environmental law cannot be overstated. You know, in 1972-73, when we joined, Ireland had practically no environmental law on the Irish statute books. There were a few measures, you know, ad hoc measures. There were some regulations on birds that were useful for agriculture. And even after our membership, we did adopt some environmental legislation that was not driven by EU requirements, such as the 1976 Wildlife Act. But that was all very quickly overtaken by the requirement to comply with particular rules developed at the EU level. Now, we also, before our membership, we had common law actions or common law remedies that one could seek in the law of tort. For example, nuisance. But really, this was to do with, you know, a remedy for one landowner's unreasonable use of their land, which was unreasonably interfering with another landowner's use of their land or enjoyment of their land. So it was more to do with protecting private interests than protecting the public interest in the environment.
So today, and individual rights really were the focus rather than the actual environment itself.
Exactly. There was no concept really of that you know, community or public interest in a clean environment. And where that's moved after 50 years, practically Ireland's entire legislative code, you know, on environmental protection and environmental regulation now originates in EU legal requirements. So all of the measures we have now in our statute books actually are driven by and are introduced in Ireland to comply with European requirements. If you think of, you know, under for water resources management, waste management, nature conservation, air quality, industrial emissions, all of it.
And even then,
horizontal measures, you know, that apply across all sectors, things like environmental impact assessment requirements, strategic environmental assessment requirements. And even when I say water management, I mean, we have big measures at EU level, like the Water Framework Directive, but then lots of specialist measures like the Nitrates Directive, for example, applying to agriculture.
Yeah, and look, in 76 we had the Wildlife Act, the early 90s, the Environmental Protection Agency. Were they all brought about as a result of EU membership?
Well, EU law didn't require Ireland to establish the EPA in 1992, but it became increasingly clear that we needed to do something. We needed to have a specialist capacitated agency. You know, there were growing requirements under EU, under individual EU measures for data gathering, for reporting, you know, regular periodic reporting on progress, for effective enforcement, and all of that really sort of dictated that we had to have a specialist agency that had the technical expertise and the political mandate and everything to do that.
What do you count then as the successes or the failures or both in terms of our implementation of legislation from the EU and Ireland in this area?
Well, we've been reasonably successful. Now, that's not to say there aren't problems, but there are problems almost everywhere in implementing what is technically complex legislation that, you know, requires a great deal of resources to enforce it and implement it correctly. I mean, the EPA, for example, are sometimes criticised for not enforcing on every case, but then they have a policy where they take a risk-based approach to enforcement, where they have regard to the nature and severity of risks to human health and environment. I would say probably one of the great successes is that where, you know, our legislature has responded by developing legislation to try and respond to the requirements of EU environmental law. And that's a big ask. It you know, sometimes we're late in doing it. Sometimes we don't legislate terribly well. But our courts have become more and more comfortable and more competent in applying the requirements of EU environmental law, even where they have not been correctly or fully transposed by Irish law. You know, our judges now are, and our practicing lawyers are much more willing now to look beyond the Irish regulations or legislation, to look at the original EU law and to try and apply that directly within our court system. So in many ways that has worked.
The law is one side of it and how it's applied, but what do you say then to what we've seen over the last number of years? When these new regulations are coming in, there has been a bit of pushback, particularly I suppose in rural areas. People are worrying about, well, how am I going to farm? How am I going to fish? How am I going to live my life with the new rules and regulations that are coming in? And the new area is climate action and all the regulations that are coming down the line as to how we'll have to change how we live our lives. And there's resistance to that at a level.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's a very interesting issue that you raised, Jerry. I mean, of course there's resistance because we really have some major problems. I mean, an awful lot of what we do and how we do it is unsustainable. And by any measure, even on you know, hard economic terms, we cannot continue to you know, do and make and grow and farm and fish and, you know, all these things the way we're doing it. And, you know, if you take, for example, we do need leadership on this, and the change will be difficult. But it's probably much better that this happens in many ways at the EU level. You know, somebody has to take leadership, whereas states acting alone often are looking for some kind of short-term advantage for themselves, for their own producers, growers, exporters. So the EU takes leadership on environmental issues and has done for some time, and in many ways that works for us. If you take climate, you know, the EU likes to take a global leadership role in climate. It's a global problem, and somebody has to sort of lead from the front. So the EU has driven, you know, every aspect of climate action, emissions trading, reduction targets for emissions, renewable energy, you know, development, energy efficiency, greenhouse gas monitoring and reporting systems, you know, standards for transport and fuels, standards for land use and land use change and how we account for that. And if you consider, somebody has to lead and identify a common technical approach, a common way that we will, you know, take action, measure that action, you know, monitor and measure progress. And if we're honest, you know, the EU's leadership on environmental law, national governments, though they often push back and though they express concern and they represent the concerns of their own local producers and growers and constituents, in many ways, national governments are happy to be coerced, if you like, by the EU into doing this, because it relieves them of what would otherwise be a very difficult political decision. You know, nobody's saying that something doesn't have to be done, but it's a godsend in many ways for national governments to be able to blame it on the EU.
Yeah, the only way it might get done as a collective rather than individual countries and political pressure at a local level. Okay, Owen, listen, thanks very much for going through that for us and outlining how things have changed. It's Professor Owen McIntyre, professor at the School of Law in UCC, director at UCC Centre for Law and the Environment. If you have a view on what he had to say, get in touch, your own opinions on how things have changed, the way things need to go in this area as well, and get into the show on 0667123666. You can text and WhatsApp us on 083 300 300. We want to hear from you on the programme. We also have on the line, of course, to talk about this issue Grace O'Sullivan, Green Party MEP for Ireland South, and Patrick Murphy, CEO of the Irish South and West Bridge Producers Organisation. We'll be hearing as well in a moment from Paul O'Brien, Chair of the IFA Environmental and Rural Affairs Committee. And Grace, if I can ask you first of all about the way things have changed here and what Owen was going through there about the EU taking a leadership role. This obviously will continue, you'd imagine, in relation to climate action and what we'll be required to do.
That's right. And good morning, Gerry. I mean, at the start of this EU mandate in 2019, the President Ursula von der Leyen took leadership and she introduced the European Green Deal. So this is, you know, the whole legislative package on climate change and climate action, and also it's acknowledging the decrease in biodiversity across the European Union and globally, and what measures we have to take to ensure that we don't enable further decline in terms of climate. So the targets are there, and I mean, every week in the European Parliament, you know, we're seeing new strategies, the biodiversity strategy, we're seeing farm to fork strategies, different strategies that are all really clearly putting the climate crisis and biodiversity crisis and pollution and waste at the centre of all decision making in the European Union. So it's definitely the EU is taking leadership on these issues.
And are they conscious enough of the decisions being made at level of the on the ground impacts in member states of these laws, of these changes, of these regulations?
Well, the interesting thing, Gerry, is that, you know, the it's made up of 27 member states. So there's always these very interesting negotiations that take place to try to create a mechanism that works for all countries. So the EU is very, very well aware from their members of parliament as to what the issues are on the ground in the various member states. Countries. And that's one of our tasks as members of the European Parliament, to highlight these issues and to make sure that we're, you know, standing up for our own constituency areas. So I represent Ireland South, which is 12 counties, including Kerry. And, you know, it's up to us to engage extensively with the different sectors, be it business, farmers, fishers, whatever, communities in general, to make sure that we are representative at the European table, to make sure that the legislation that's been proposed is taking into account the you know, the different varieties of countries that we're representing.
Let me go to Paul O'Brien, who is chair of the IFA's Environmental and Rural Affairs Committee. And that point, I suppose, I was putting to Grace there, Brian, about how things have changed and how they're going to change. Do you think it's possible to reconcile thriving farming and fishing sectors with robust environmental laws and implementations of these regulations?
Good morning, Gerry, and to your panellists here as well. Look, I think there's a number of things there that we need to be very cautious of. I do understand that the journey that the EU has gone on over the last 50 years, it has most certainly helped to bring people from a position of, you know, poverty and a position of, you know, challenging economic circumstances. But now we've evolved. And if the EU wishes us to evolve as a industry, particularly in agriculture, and I would say fisheries the same, that, you know, what we really also need is a sustainable income as well. It does appear, and a lot of the farmers that talk to me on a regular basis would suggest that, you know, the EU has now balanced in more, most certainly environmental ambition, but at the loss of food security. You know, we are in a nation that has fundamentally, you know, driven by, we produce food. It's what we do best. It's our best natural resource. We have to be doing that in a very environmentally sustainable way. I agree that, you know, the whole biodiversity issue needs to be embraced by farmers, and all of these different measures need to be done. But we have to design policies that allow farmers a sustainable, good living. And really, when I'm coming from that angle, new schemes that have been announced recently, they're disappointing. I know that's at a national level, that's not most certainly at European level, but they are being driven by the European agenda.
Yeah, and that's not always taking enough account from your point of view of farming incomes. Okay, stay with us on the line. We're going to talk a bit more about this on EU and Me. If you have a view on how things have changed, environmental regulations and rules and laws, and how it's changed, has it improved things? Is it too onerous at the ground level in terms of the income of farmers and fishermen and others? We want to hear from you, with Grace O'Sullivan, the Green Party, with Paul O'Brien of the IFA, and Patrick Murphy, CEO of the Irish Salt and Fish Producers, on the line. We'll have more with them on EU and Me after we take these.
The EU and Me, brought to you with the support of the Department of Foreign Affairs, Communicating Europe Initiative.
Yeah, we're talking EU and me. We've got Grace O'Sullivan, Green Party MVP for Ireland South, on the line, Paul O'Brien, Chair of the IFA Environmental and Rural Affairs Committee, and Patrick Murphy, CEO of the Irish South and West Fish Producers Organisation. Patrick, I'll ask you that question. Look, things have changed a lot. It has a huge impact on fishing and fisheries policy, particularly, I suppose, when it comes to maybe protecting and revitalising fishing stocks. But that same question comes in about how do you balance the need to protect with the need to enable fishermen here to earn a living?
Well, Jerry, we'll start with your first guest, in fairness now, and it's about the law. And there's a lot of regulations in Europe, and we like all the regulations to be enforced with equal measure. So regulation EU number 1380 of 2013 states, under Article 2, to contribute to an efficient and transparent internal market for fisheries and aquaculture products, and contribute to a level playing field for fisheries and aquaculture. Mm. And it also states that it has to have a fair income for fishers in it. So we'll come back to more regulations. Recently, just this really highlights it. Regulation 2016-2336 on vulnerable marine ecosystems, VMEs. So we had a scenario where the Commission looked for scientific advice from ICES, and ICES provided that, but they gave four or five different scenarios. And those scenarios has led to the loss of fishing grounds in the Porcupine, the area we protected from the Russians with their military exercises. And we weren't consulted about this. It came through a different DG Envy rather than through DG Mara. Mm-hmm. And when Grace says that she's consulting with us about this, did she know about this regulation? And if she did, where was the consultation with us? Now, we have a scenario where our government has to go back to the Commission and challenge them on a legal point of what they had said and what is under the regulations. So if we're going to talk about introducing regulations into our country, let's see them coming in fairly. We've seen Ireland lose 25% of its fish on a trade deal with the EU. Under no provision in any article or any regulation was this, because it was an extraordinary event that was never foreseen before in the history of the European Union, that a state would leave. They weren't prepared for it. Yet we were absolutely crucified as a country with 29% of the fishing grounds. And we have a scenario now, Jerry, where one third of our offshore fishing vessels have to leave the industry to make room for other boats coming in fishing inside in our waters. We have a scenario where, under EU laws, countries have delegated acts that they can allow their fish to be put into the back of lorries with no checks or balances here, but if fish from those same lorries are sold into a factory here, every single box is weighed. So we don't see a level playing field. We see all these laws, Jerry, it is leading to the destruction of Irish indigenous people's heritage.
Okay, I'll take her point.
And their ability to earn a living.
Let Grace respond. Patrick, what's your response to Pat? Grace, what's your response to Patrick's concerns as outlined there?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I just say, you know, Patrick has always been someone who has represented the fishing sector very, very well, you know. And I mean, the whole point is to try to make sure that as we operate within the European Union, that, you know, that there's a fairness in the system. And certainly in Ireland, there is very much a sense and a reality, as Patrick says, that we are not getting our fair share, or, as Patrick said, that the level playing field, that we're not measuring up to that. So it is something in the Fisheries Committee that we have been pushing and fighting for. And Patrick, the beauty about people like Patrick, who represents the South-South West Fish Producers Group and others around the country, is that they do have access to the European Commission. And they do, you know, I'm even recently now I was engaging with the IMRO, which is the heritage fisheries, the island heritage fisheries, you know, and the struggles they have. So one way or another, it's always going to be, there's always going to be tension to try to get
get the balance people, right.
You know, like, yeah, Patrick, get the balance right. But and the beauty about what Patrick says is, you know, that we do have to stay within the bounds of legislation, and that's fair and recognised. But you know, it's not all plain sailing. You know, we're going to have to fight for everything we can get on fisheries, and that's for sure.
All right, let me ask this final question to all three of you. Patrick, I'll start with you. What are your hopes for the next 50 years in this area? A lot of change coming in environment and climate action in particular.
We'll start with the positives. We have the richest fishing grounds in Europe. We have the best resources. We have the most skilled talent. But if we lose that now, Gerry, then the future is bleak. Look, again, just to point out, we have Article 26.2 of IMFAF under Regulation 2021-1139, where it provided for an exceptional circumstances causing a significant disruption to markets, compensation to operators in the fishery and aquaculture sector for their income and foregone additional costs. Now, we in this country haven't seen one cent of that aid being given to fishermen, even though there's €5.5 million available that's sitting in an account, isn't allocated to anyone, and we're screaming for that to allow fishermen just to continue to go to sea.
That's something you want to see for the future. I'm short of time.
So Paul, Grace is online now saying that she's communicating with us. You mentioned one organisation, Imro. Yeah. There's a lot of other fishing organisations.
And you want to see more talk, and there will be. I'll have to move it on. Paul O'Brien, same question to you. Your hopes for the future, briefly.
Well, look, whether we like it or not, you know, that we understand that there is going to be immense change expected of our farmers. The world's population will increase by 2 billion people in the next 20, 30 years. They have to be fed. They need 3 square meals a day. Now, surely now there has to be more focus on food stability going forward. We can do that in Ireland. We have the luxury that we can produce food in a sustainable way. But policies need to be driven very, very much by the EU
in that direction.
Very much clarity to farmers that they can still have a secure future going forward.
Spot on.
They can produce food, they can produce energy crops if needed, but they have to have a viable income into the future.
Okay, Paul, brilliant stuff. Listen, I'm going to go to Trasa Murphy, Radio Kerry, news editors with us in our studio in Tralee. Trasa, we've been carrying out an EU and Me survey over the last number of weeks. You've got some results for us.
Yes, Gerry. Those who took part in Radio Kerry's online survey were asked, first of all, do you think Ireland has benefited from EU membership? The results are 86% of those who took part in the survey said yes, 14% no.
Those who took part in the survey were asked, what, if any, do you consider to be the most important benefits of joining the EU? What did that find?
Yes, according to the survey participants, the number one benefit of joining the EU was that it helped transform our economy. More than one in five chose this as their number one option. In second place was access to and inclusion in a single market. In joint third place then was joining the EU, helping steer through legislation to protect women's rights better, funding for infrastructure and freedom of movement and travel. In joint fourth place, there was they felt that farming and cap supports, that was the main benefit for joining the EU, and protection for their environment. And there were actually no votes, no support. Nobody thought there was any benefit to joining the EU when it came to rural development, common fisheries policy, and better workers' rights. And also, I should say as well, better consumer rights was in fourth place as well. So better consumer rights, farming and cap supports, protection for our environment, they were in fourth place.
Okay, brilliant stuff. And lots of feedback and statements from people talking about the joining the EU and it giving Ireland increased markets, increased opportunities for Irish companies into markets. We're geographically small and isolated, have a small population, we have a strong economy in our own right, access to single market under unified currency, provides security and strength within a globalised and bullish world economy. The single market was the most transformative aspect from Ireland's perspective in terms of its rapid economic development from the mid-1990s onwards, and those are just some of the reactions that we were getting. We'll have more and put them up on our social media as well. My thanks to all of you for taking, we're out of time. My thanks to all of you for taking part in EU and Me and Kerry today this morning.